Good morning, friends. Happy Easter, the third Sunday of Easter in the pastor's study here at home. In the photograph from a charming small town somewhere in the American heartland, a man with long silvery hair, a leather vest, and a pair of lived-in blue jeans with a biker belt is standing before a small gathering of motorcycles and their bikers. On what appears to be a bracing spring morning, overcast and verdant, Daryl Best is offering a blessing for a safe motorcycle season. He's a safety and education representative for a campaign that took place about 10 years ago, whose motto was, Start Seeing Motorcycles. As a safety awareness campaign, it was aimed at both motorcyclists and all other drivers, but the motto has an obvious implication for one of those groups in particular, all other drivers, on four or more wheels, who pass by or around or behind or in front of or at intersections with motorcycles all the time. It was believed that it was time for them to start seeing what had always been there, in front of their eyes, but somehow so easily missed or ignored that, as far as most drivers knew, it was usually hidden from their view, if it was even to be believed that it had ever been there at all. Daryl Best offered some reasons for that. Motorcycles are smaller and look farther away than they actually are. It's easy for them to be in a car or truck driver's blind spot. The structure of a car can hide the cyclist from the driver's view. It looks farther away than it actually is. It's easy for it to be in our blind spot. The structures that we move in can hide it from our view. While the two grieving disciples were talking and discussing, Jesus himself came near and went with them, but their eyes were kept from recognizing him. Bill Bryson's book of travels around Australia from 2000 touches occasionally on the unseen people, the Aborigines. In several anecdotes throughout the book, he gets the impression that Australia's indigenous people are practically invisible to the mainstream society, even as there are and have been many white individuals who are quite caring and interested. That specific part of the history of the last 200 years in Australia is breathtakingly, achingly cruel and tragic, exasperating in the insanity of its casual brutality. Toward the end of his book, Bryson is having some coffee in one of the cities, and he notices that all the Aboriginal people he sees, for reasons he wonders about but doesn't explore in depth, seem to have injuries, maladies, wounds of one kind or another. In Bryson's observation, the people on the street were overwhelmingly white Australians, but there were Aborigines about, too. Not great numbers of them, but always there, on the edge of the frame, unobtrusive, nearly always silent, peripheral. The white people never looked at the Aborigines, and the Aborigines never looked at the white people. The two races seemed to inhabit separate but parallel universes. Later he wrote, as I sat with my coffee and watched the mixed crowds, I realized that I didn't have the faintest idea what the solution to all this was. If I were contracted by the Commonwealth of Australia to advise on Aboriginal issues, all I could write would be, do more, try harder, start now. So, without an original or helpful thought in my head, this is still Bryson speaking, I just sat for some minutes and watched these poor, disconnected people shuffle past. Then I did what most white Australians do. I read my newspaper and drank my coffee, and I didn't see them anymore. For many of us, in many aspects of our lives, including our social ethics, our relationships, or our lack of relationship with people who have less historically inherited power than we do, I do. Our spiritual awareness, our sense of whether I'm doing what I was put here to do and living up to the promise that God invested in me from, according to Ephesians, before the foundation of the world. for most or all of us in those and other aspects of our lives, our prayer of confession and our daily charge is pretty much what Bill Bryson listed in the face of not knowing what in the world else to suggest. Do more. Try harder. Start now. Because there is so much right before our eyes that we don't even see. I guess it may give some measure of comfort to realize that from day one of the era of the resurrected Christ, evening on the first day, good, faithful, conscientious disciples have been not seeing. This guy Cleopas and his traveling conversation partner, by all appearances, kind, faithful, intelligent, humane people, stand for all of us disciples, not seeing Jesus in the stranger who walks with them, not seeing Jesus while we walk along, not seeing Jesus even when we are telling the story, not seeing Jesus when it's almost evening and the day is nearly over, not even seeing Jesus among us when we invite someone into safe shelter and share our food with them at the table. What could be more right and good and humane and even risk-taking? There's no moral here in this story that says these two idiots, you know, failed to behave in a Christian way, and so God punished them by not letting them see him. Wrong. It's entirely the opposite. They welcomed a stranger into their shelter and fed him at their table. That's Luke going one better than Matthew, who gave us that beautiful chapter, Matthew 25, in which Jesus says, "Blessed are you when you do this for the least of these, for when you do it to them, you do it to me." In Luke, he's the stranger that they shelter and feed. It wasn't until that first post-resurrection communion, Jesus took bread and blessed and broke it and gave it to them. Then our eyes are opened and we recognize him. That sacred, usually unexpected moment when we become an unsuspecting recipient of the divine grace of knowing and feeling his presence. This is not like the medieval Brother Lawrence who wrote about the practice of the presence of God, or any of the other hundreds of mystics and spiritual giants over the centuries who have dedicated their lives and tried to share with and teach people other people about having those moments of spiritual openness and presenting yourself. This is all as recipients of a divine grace of knowing and feeling God's presence, but only as a glimpse before he vanishes from our sight. Have you ever had a moment like that? If you haven't, I promise you it's okay. There's nothing wrong with you. I've had three that come powerfully to mind, two of which were times when I was in desperate spiritual circumstances. Once it was a sense of assurance, kind of a "don't worry, I've got this" sort of announcement, kind of that just sort of came out of the blue. The other time, it was an almost tactile feeling of a loving arm being unexpectedly draped over my shoulder that just came to me in the emotional darkness for about 1 second, and which that 1 second was enough. The other time I think of at the moment was so mundane that it left me with the mildly disconcerting suspicion that the Most High Maker of the universe had just reached out from the holy depths of eternity to play peekaboo with a 42-year-old who was just sitting there minding my own business. I don't usually talk about those kinds of experiences specifically because, by nature, they sound so questionable, so kind of flimsy, sort of, that sounds like it was probably just your imagination. You may not be telling me that, but trust me, even at this moment, there's a place inside me where I'm saying it to myself. The truth is, while Easter is about the joy of Christ's resurrection, we can know that from a faith perspective, but we don't always feel it. I'm still entertained by the title of a book by a spirituality writer named Jack Kornfield that talks about how Easter is exciting and it can be a big kind of jolt for our faith. But as soon as church is over on that day, we still have our mundane lives and responsibilities to deal with. The book is titled, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry. Along with those disciples, on the first evening of a totally changed universe, wherein love has decisively and irrevocably overcome death and a new life has begun, we have received an assurance that even after the cosmic and universal triumph of Easter, our familiar, common, earthly life still goes on. Said the other way around, even as life goes on, Easter has triumphed. God is always God, and God is always love, and Jesus is always breathing peace into the world, and offering not only for you, but in you and through you, springs of the water of life to nourish all creation. It's real when you feel it, and by definition, it's just as real when you're not particularly feeling it. The poet Marie Howe, thinking about the astrophysicist Stephen Hawking, wrote about what science calls the Big Bang and what is, from a faith perspective, God's conception of all existence, how in a moment that is both incomprehensible and plainly undeniable, once there was nothing, not even empty space, as a writer named Robert Misen said, there wasn't even anything to be empty in. Once there was nothing, and then there was something. The Big Bang theory starts with a singularity, the idea that all matter and all everything, every atom that exists in the universe, every sun, every galaxy, every tree, every cedarwood shoe tree, everything was in the beginning impossibly condensed into one atom that exploded and formed, or is still forming, the universe, the physical universe. Maybe that's the way God did it. It would be entirely compatible with the foundations of what Christians believe, namely four words, in the beginning, God. The poem by Marie Howe is called Singularity. Do you sometimes want to wake up to the singularity we once were? So compact, nobody needed a bed or food or money. Nobody hiding in the school bathroom or home alone, pulling open the drawer where the pills are kept. For every atom belonging to me, as good belongs to you. Remember, there was no nature, no them, no tests to determine if the elephant grieves her calf or if the coral reef feels pain. Trashed oceans don't speak English or Farsi or French. Would that we could wake up to what we were when we were ocean, and before that to when sky was earth and animal was energy and rock was liquid and stars were space, and space was not at all, nothing. Before we came to believe humans were so important, before this awful loneliness, can molecules recall it, what once was, before anything happened? No I, no we, no one, no was, no verb, no noun, only a tiny, tiny dot brimming with is all everything home. The Royal Hospital Chelsea in London is a hospital and care facility for British soldiers who've given up their pension to live out their final years there. Outside the building, easily seen by all the public passing by, is a large monumental obelisk onto which is inscribed at a level where it meets your sight line, words attributed to a commander, a British commander from the 17th century. If I forget thee, do not thou forget me. Those lines are attributed as a prayer that was said before battle. I was one half part of a prayer that was said before battle. But inscribed there on that obelisk outside the hospital, they particularly resonate for all who pass by. Soldiers on the inside being cared for in their twilight years. If I forget thee, do not forget me. I know you don't always remember, God says, but I remember you. I know you don't always see me, but I see you. And you may or may not be feeling in love with me at any given time, but I always, always, always love you. May all of our hearts burn within us when he tells us what we are. And even when you can't see Jesus, may you know deep in your bones that it's okay, that he's still right there beside you, walking with you, teaching you, accepting your gracious hospitality, and eating at your table.